Something sophisticated, say an antimatter bomb or a mini black hole, well, that might take a few months. Thank you. Could you start looking into it? But as I've said, I don't believe it would work. Surely something that can handle such powers must also be able to protect itself against them. So, any other suggestions? Can we negotiate? One counselor asked, not very hopefully. With what? Or whom? Krausman answered. As we discovered, the monolith is essentially a pure mechanism, doing just what it's been programmed to do. Perhaps that program is flexible enough to allow of changes, but there's no way we can tell. And we certainly can't appeal to head office. That's 500,000 light-years away. Poole listened without interrupting. There was nothing he could contribute to the discussion, and indeed much of it was completely over his head. He began to feel an insidious sense of depression. Would it have been better, he wondered, not to pass on this information? Then, if it was a false alarm, no one would be any the worse. And if it was not, well, humanity would still have peace of mind before whatever inescapable doom awaited it. He was still mulling over these gloomy thoughts when he was suddenly alerted by a familiar phrase. A quiet little member of the committee, with a name so long and difficult that Poole had never been able to remember, still less pronounce it, had abruptly dropped just two words into the discussion. Trojan horse. There was one of those silences generally described as pregnant, then a chorus of, "Why didn't I think of that? Of course, very good idea," until the chairperson, for the first time in the session, had to call for order. "Thank you, Professor Therugnanasampanthamurthy," said Dr. O'Connor without missing a beat. "Would you like to be more specific?" "Certainly. If the monolith is indeed, as everyone seems to think, essentially a machine without consciousness, and hence with only limited self-monitoring ability, we may already have the weapons that can defeat it locked up in the vault."
"And a delivery system. Howman."
"Precisely.
Just a minute, Dr. T. We know nothing, absolutely nothing, about the monolith's architecture. How can we be sure that anything our primitive species ever designed would be effective against it?"
"We can't. But remember this. However sophisticated it is, the monolith has to obey exactly the same universal laws of logic that Aristotle and Boole formulated centuries ago. That's why it may, no, should, be vulnerable to the things locked up in the vault. We have to assemble them in such a way that at least one of them will work. It's our only hope, unless anybody can suggest a better alternative."
"Excuse me," said Poole, finally losing patience. "Will someone kindly tell me what and where is this famous vault you're talking about?"
Chapter 36. Chamber of Horrors. History is full of nightmares, some natural, some man-made. By the end of the 21st century, most of the natural ones, smallpox, the Black Death, AIDS, the hideous viruses lurking in the African jungle, had been eliminated, or at least brought under control, by the advance of medicine. However, it was never wise to underestimate the ingenuity of Mother Nature. And no one doubted that the future would still have unpleasant biological surprises in store for mankind. It seemed a sensible precaution, therefore, to keep a few specimens of all these horrors for scientific study, carefully guarded, of course, so that there was no possibility of them escaping and again wreaking havoc on the human race. But how could one be absolutely sure that there was no danger of this happening? There had been, understandably, quite an outcry in the late 20th century when it was proposed to keep the last known smallpox viruses at disease control centers in the United States and Russia. However unlikely it might be,
There was a finite possibility that they might be released by such accidents as earthquakes, equipment failures, or even deliberate sabotage by terrorist groups. A solution that satisfied everyone, except a few preserved the lunar wilderness extremists, was to ship them to the moon, and to keep them in a laboratory at the end of a kilometer-long shaft drilled into the isolated mountain Pico, one of the most prominent features of the Mare Imbrium. And here, over the years, they were joined by some of the most outstanding examples of misplaced human ingenuity, indeed insanity. There were gases and mists that, even in microscopic doses, caused slow or instant death. Some had been created by religious cultists who, though mentally deranged, had managed to acquire considerable scientific knowledge. Many of them believed that the end of the world was at hand, when, of course, only their followers would be saved. In case God was absent-minded enough not to perform as scheduled, they wanted to make sure that they could rectify his unfortunate oversight. The first assaults of these lethal cultists were made on such vulnerable targets as crowded subways, world fairs, sports stadiums, pop concerts. Tens of thousands were killed and many more injured before the madness was brought under control in the early 21st century. As often happens, some good came out of evil, because it forced the world's law enforcement agencies to cooperate as never before. Even rogue states which had promoted political terrorism were unable to tolerate this random and wholly unpredictable variety. The chemical and biological agents used in these attacks, as well as in earlier forms of warfare, joined the deadly collection in Pico. Their antidotes, when they existed, were also stored with them. It was hoped that none of this material would ever concern humanity again, but it was still available, under heavy guard, if it was needed in some desperate emergency. The third category of items stored in the Pico Vault, although they could be classified as plagues, had never killed or injured anyone, directly. They had not even existed before the late 20th century, but in a few decades they had done billions of dollars worth of damage, and often wrecked lives as effectively as any bodily illness could have done. They were the diseases which attacked mankind's newest and most versatile servant, the computer. Taking names from the medical dictionaries, viruses, prions, tapeworms, they were programs that often mimicked, with uncanny accuracy, the behavior of their organic relatives. Some were harmless, little more than playful jokes, contrived to surprise or amuse computer operators by unexpected messages and images on their visual displays. Others were far more malicious, deliberately designed agents of catastrophe. In most cases, their purpose was entirely mercenary. They were the weapons that sophisticated criminals used to blackmail the banks and commercial organizations that now depended utterly upon the efficient operation of their computer systems. On being warned that their data banks would be erased automatically at a certain time, unless they transferred a few megadollars to some anonymous offshore number, most victims decided not to risk possibly irreparable disaster. They paid up quietly. Often, to avoid public or even private embarrassment, without notifying the police. This understandable desire for privacy made it easy for the network highwaymen to conduct their electronic holdups. Even when they were caught, they were treated gently by legal systems which did not know how to handle such novel crimes. And, after all, they had not really hurt anyone, had they? Indeed, after they had served their brief sentences, many of the perpetrators were quietly hired by their victims on the old principle that poachers make the best gamekeepers. These computer criminals were driven purely by greed, and certainly did not wish to destroy the organizations they preyed upon. No sensible parasite kills its host. But there were other and much more dangerous enemies of society at work. Usually they were maladjusted individuals,
typically adolescent males, working entirely alone and, of course, in complete secrecy. Their aim was to create programs which would simply create havoc and confusion when they had been spread over the planet by the worldwide cable and radio networks, or on physical carriers such as diskettes and CD-ROMs. Then they would enjoy the resulting chaos, basking in the sense of power it gave their pitiful psyches. Sometimes these perverted geniuses were discovered and adopted by national intelligence agencies for their own secretive purposes, usually to break into the data banks of their rivals. This was a fairly harmless line of employment, as the organizations concerned did at least have some sense of civic responsibility. Not so the apocalyptic sects, who were delighted to discover this new armory, holding weapons far more effective and more easily disseminated than gas or germs, and much more difficult to counter, since they could be broadcast instantaneously to millions of offices and homes. The collapse of the New York Havana Bank in 2005, the launching of Indian nuclear missiles in 2007, luckily with their warheads unactivated, the shutdown of pan-European air traffic control in 2008, the paralysis of the North American telephone network in that same year, all these were cult-inspired rehearsals for doomsday. Thanks to brilliant feats of counterintelligence by normally uncooperative and even warring national agencies, this menace was slowly brought under control. At least, so it was generally believed. There had been no serious attacks at the very foundations of society for several hundred years. One of the chief weapons of victory had been the brain cap, though there were some who believed that this achievement had been bought at too great a cost. Though arguments over the freedom of the individual versus the duties of the state were old when Plato and Aristotle attempted to codify them, and would probably continue until the end of time, some consensus had been reached in the third millennium. It was generally agreed that communism was the most perfect form of government. Unfortunately, it had been demonstrated, at the cost of some hundreds of millions of lives, that it was only applicable to social insects, robots class 2, and similar restricted categories. For imperfect human beings, the least worst answer was demococracy, frequently defined as individual greed moderated by an efficient but not too zealous government. Soon after the brain cap came into general use, some highly intelligent and maximally zealous bureaucrats realized that it had a unique potential as an early warning system. During the setting-up process, when the new wearer was being mentally calibrated, it was possible to detect many forms of psychosis before they had a chance of becoming dangerous. Often this suggested the best therapy, but when no cure appeared possible, the subject could be electronically tagged, or, in extreme cases, segregated from society. Of course, this mental monitoring could test only those who were fitted with a brain cap, but by the end of the third millennium, this was as essential for everyday life as the personal telephone had been at its beginning. In fact, anyone who did not join the vast majority was automatically suspect and checked as a potential deviant. Needless to say, when mind-probing, as its critics called it, started coming into general use, there were cries of outrage from civil rights organizations. One of their most effective slogans was, "Brain cap or brain cop?" Slowly, even reluctantly, it was accepted that this form of monitoring was a necessary precaution against far worse evils. And it was no coincidence that with the general improvement in mental health, religious fanaticism also started its rapid decline. When the long drawn-out war against the cybernet criminals ended, the victors found themselves owning an embarrassing collection of spoils, all of them utterly incomprehensible to any past conqueror. There were, of course, hundreds of computer viruses, most of them very difficult to detect and kill. And there were some entities, for want of a better name, that were much more terrifying. They were brilliantly invented diseases for which there was no cure, in some cases, not even the possibility of a cure. Many of them had been linked to great mathematicians who would have been horrified by this corruption of their discoveries. As it is a human characteristic to belittle a real danger by giving it an absurd name, the designations were often facetious. The Girdle Gremlin, the Mandelbrot Maze, the Combinatorial Catastrophe, the Transfinite Trap, the Conway Conundrum, the Turing Torpedo, the Lorentz Labyrinth, the Boolean Bomb, the Shannon Snare, the Cantor Cataclysm. If any generalization was possible, all these mathematical horrors operated on the same principle. They did not depend for their effectiveness on anything as naive as memory erasure or code corruption. On the contrary, their approach was more subtle. They persuaded their host machine to initiate a program which could not be completed before the end of the universe, or which, the Mandelbrot Maze was the deadliest example, involved a literally infinite series of steps. A trivial example would be the calculation of pi, or any other irrational number. However, even the most simple electro-optic computer would not fall into such a simple trap. The day had long since passed when mechanical morons would wear out their gears, grinding them to powder as they tried to divide by zero. The challenge to the demon programmers was to convince their targets that the task set them had a definite conclusion that could be reached in a finite time. In the battle of wits between man, seldom woman, despite such role models as Lady Ada Lovelace, Admiral Grace Hopper, and Dr. Susan Calvin, and machine, the machine almost invariably lost. It would have been possible, though in some cases difficult and even risky, to destroy the captured obscenities by erase-stroke-overwrite commands. But they represented an enormous investment in time and ingenuity which, however misguided, seemed a pity to waste. And, more important, perhaps they should be kept for study in some secure location as a safeguard against the time when some evil genius might reinvent and deploy them. The solution was obvious. The digital demons should be sealed with their chemical and biological counterparts, it was hoped forever, in the Pico Vault. Chapter 37 Operation Damocles. Poole had never had much contact with the team who assembled the weapon everyone hoped would never have to be used. The operation, ominously but aptly named Damocles, was so highly specialized that he could contribute nothing directly, and he saw enough of the task force to realize that some of them might almost belong to an alien species. Indeed, one key member was apparently in a lunatic asylum. Poole had been surprised to find that such places still existed, and Chairperson O'Connor sometimes suggested that at least two others should join him. "Have you ever heard of the Enigma Project?" she remarked to Poole after a particularly frustrating session. When he shook his head, she continued, "I'm surprised. It was only a few decades before you were born. I came across it when I was researching material for Damocles. Very similar problem. In one of your wars, a group of brilliant mathematicians was gathered together in great secrecy to break an enemy code. Incidentally, they built one of the very first real computers to make the job possible. And there's a lovely story, I hope it's true, that reminds me of our own little team. One day the Prime Minister came on a visit of inspection, and afterwards he said to Enigma's director, 'When I told you to leave no stone unturned to get the men you needed, I didn't expect you to take me so literally.' Presumably all the right stones had been turned for Project Damocles. However,
As no one knew whether they were working against a deadline of days, weeks, or years, at first it was hard to generate any sense of urgency. The need for secrecy also created problems. Since there was no point in spreading alarm throughout the solar system, not more than 50 people knew of the project. But they were the people who mattered, who could marshal all the forces necessary, and who alone could authorize the opening of the Pico Vault for the first time in 500 years. When Hallman reported that the monolith was receiving messages with increasing frequency, there seemed little doubt that something was going to happen. Poole was not the only one who found it hard to sleep in those days, even with the help of the BrainCap's anti-insomnia programs. Before he finally did get to sleep, he often wondered if he would wake up again. But at last, all the components of the weapon were assembled. A weapon invisible, untouchable, and unimaginable to almost all the warriors who had ever lived. Nothing could have looked more harmless and innocent than the perfectly standard terabyte memory tablet used with millions of brain caps every day. But the fact that it was encased in a massive block of crystalline material, crisscrossed with metal bands, indicated that it was something quite out of the ordinary. Poole received it with reluctance. He wondered if the courier who had been given the awesome task of carrying the Hiroshima atom bomb's core to the Pacific Air Base from which it was launched had felt the same way. And yet, if all their fears were justified, his responsibility might be even greater. And he could not be certain that even the first part of his mission would be successful. Because no circuit could be absolutely secure, Hallman had not yet been informed about Project Damocles. Poole would do that when he returned to Ganymede. Then he could only hope that Hallman would be willing to play the role of Trojan horse, and perhaps be destroyed in the process. Chapter 38. Preemptive Strike. It was strange to be back in the Hotel Ganymede after all these years. Strangest of all because it seemed completely unchanged, despite everything that had happened. Poole was still greeted by the familiar image of Bowman as he walked into the suite named after him, and, as he expected, Bowman stroke Hallman was waiting, looking slightly less substantial than the ancient hologram. Before they could even exchange greetings, there was an interruption that Poole would have welcomed at any other time than this. The room vidphone gave its urgent trio of rising notes, also unchanged since his last visit, and an old friend appeared on the screen.
"Frank!" cried Theodore Kahn. "Why didn't you tell me you were coming? When can we meet? Why no video? Someone with you? And who were all those official-looking types who landed at the same time?"
"Please, Ted."
"Yes, I'm sorry, but believe me, I've got very good reasons. I'll explain later. And I do have someone with me. Call you back just as soon as I can. Goodbye."
As he belatedly gave the "do not disturb" order, Poole said apologetically,
"Sorry about that. You know who it was, of course."
"Yes. Dr. Kahn. He often tried to get in touch with me. But you never answered. May I ask why?" Though there were far more important matters to worry about, Poole could not resist putting the question.
"Ours was the only channel I wished to keep open. Also, I was often away. Sometimes for years."
That was surprising. Yet it should not have been.
Poole knew well enough that Hallman had been reported in many places, in many times, yet away for years? He might have visited quite a few star systems. Perhaps that was how he knew about Nova Scorpio, only 40 light-years distant. But he could never have gone all the way to the node. There and back would have been a 900-year journey.
"How lucky that you were here when we needed you."
It was very unusual for Hallman to hesitate before replying. There was much longer than the unavoidable 3-second time lag before he said slowly,
"Are you sure that it was luck?"
What do you mean? I do not wish to talk about it, but twice I have glimpsed powers, entities, far superior to the monoliths, and perhaps even their makers. We may both have less freedom than we imagine.
That was indeed a chilling thought. Poole needed a deliberate effort of will to put it aside and concentrate on the immediate problem.
Let us hope we have enough free will to do what is necessary. Perhaps this is a foolish question. Does the monolith know that we are meeting? Could it be suspicious?
It is not capable of such an emotion. It has numerous fault protection devices, some of which I understand, but that is all.
Could it be overhearing us now?
I do not believe so.
I wish that I could be sure it was such a naive and simple-minded super-genius, thought Poole as he unlocked his briefcase and took out the sealed box containing the tablet. In this low gravity, its weight was almost negligible. It was impossible to believe that it might hold the destiny of mankind. There was no way we could be certain of getting a secure circuit to you, so we couldn't go into details. This tablet contains programs which we hope will prevent the monolith from carrying out any orders which threaten mankind. There are 20 of the most devastating viruses ever designed on this, most of which have no known antidote. In some cases, it is believed that none is possible. There are 5 copies of each. We would like you to release them when, and if, you think it necessary. Dave? Hal? No one has ever been given such a responsibility, but we have no other choice.
Once again, the reply seemed to take longer than the 3-second round trip from Europa.
If we do this, all the monolith's functions may cease. We are uncertain what will happen to us then.
We have considered that, of course, but by this time you must surely have many facilities at your command, some of them probably beyond our understanding. I am also sending you a petabyte memory tablet. 10 to the 15th bytes is more than sufficient to hold all the memories and experiences of many lifetimes. This will give you one escape route. I suspect you have others.
Correct. We will decide which to use at the appropriate time.
Poole relaxed, as far as was possible in this extraordinary situation. Alman was willing to cooperate. He still had sufficient links with his origins.
Now, we have to get this tablet to you, physically. Its contents are too dangerous to risk sending over any radio or optical channel. I know you possess long-range control of matter. Did you not once detonate an orbiting bomb? Could you transport it to Europa? Alternatively, we could send it in an auto courier to any point you specify.
That would be best. I will collect it in Cienville. Here are the coordinates.
Poole was still slumped in his chair when the Bowman suite monitor admitted the head of the delegation that had accompanied him from Earth. Whether Colonel Jones was a genuine colonel, or even if his name was Jones, were minor mysteries which Poole was not really interested in solving. It was sufficient that he was a superb organizer and had handled the mechanics of Operation Damocles with quiet efficiency.
"Well, Frank, it's on its way. We'll be landing in 1 hour 10 minutes. I assume that Halman can take it from there, but I don't understand how he can actually handle, is that the right word, these tablets."
I wondered about that, until someone on the Europa Committee explained it. There's a well-known, though not to me, theorem stating that any computer can emulate any other computer. So I'm sure that Halman knows exactly what he's doing. He would never have agreed otherwise.
"I hope you're right," replied the colonel. "If not, well, I don't know what alternative we have."
There was a gloomy pause until Poole did his best to relieve the tension.
"By the way, have you heard the local rumor about our visit?"
"Which particular one?"
"That we're a special commission sent here to investigate crime and corruption in this raw frontier township. The mayor and the sheriff are supposed to be running scared.
How I envy them, said Colonel Jones. Sometimes it's quite a relief to have something trivial to worry about.
Chapter 39 Deicide. Like all the inhabitants of Anubis City, population now 56,521, Dr. Theodore Kahn woke soon after local midnight to the sound of the general alarm. His first reaction was, "Not another ice quake, for Deus's sake!" He rushed to the window, shouting, "Open!" so loudly that the room did not understand, and he had to repeat the order in a normal voice. The light of Lucifer should have come streaming in, painting the patterns on the floor that so fascinated visitors from Earth, because they never moved even a fraction of a millimeter, no matter how long they waited. That unvarying beam of light was no longer there. As Kahn stared in utter disbelief through the huge, transparent bubble of the Anubis Dome, he saw a sky that Ganymede had not known for 1,000 years. It was once more ablaze with stars. Lucifer had gone. And then, as he explored the forgotten constellations, Kahn noticed something even more terrifying. Where Lucifer should have been was a tiny disk of absolute blackness, eclipsing the unfamiliar stars. There was only one possible explanation, Kahn told himself numbly. Lucifer has been swallowed by a black hole. And it may be our turn next. On the balcony of the Ganymede Hotel, Poole was watching the same spectacle, but with more complex emotions. Even before the general alarm, his comsec had woken him with a message from Halman. "It is beginning. We have infected the monolith, but one, perhaps several, of the viruses have entered our own circuits. We do not know if we will be able to use the memory tablet you have given us. If we succeed, we will meet you in Sienville." Then came the surprising and strangely moving words, whose exact emotional content would be debated for generations. "If we are unable to download, remember us." From the room behind him, Poole heard the voice of the mayor, doing his best to reassure the now sleepless citizens of Anubis. Though he opened with that most terrifying of official statements, no cause for alarm, the mayor did indeed have words of comfort. "We don't know what's happening, but Lucifer's still shining normally. I repeat, Lucifer is still shining. We've just received news from the interorbit shuttle Alcyone, which left for Callisto half an hour ago. Here's their view." Poole left the balcony and rushed into his room just in time to see Lucifer blaze reassuringly on the vidscreen. "What's happened," the mayor continued breathlessly, "is that something has caused a temporary eclipse. We'll zoom in to look at it. Callisto Observatory, come in, please." How does he know it's temporary, thought Poole, as he waited for the next image to come up on the screen. Lucifer vanished, to be replaced by a field of stars. At the same time, the mayor faded out and another voice took over.
2-meter telescope, but almost any instrument will do. It's a disk of perfectly black material, just over 10,000 kilometers across, so thin it shows no visible thickness, and it's placed exactly, obviously deliberately, to block Ganymede from receiving any light. We'll zoom in to see if it shows any details, though I rather doubt it.
From the viewpoint of Callisto, the occulting disk was foreshortened into an oval twice as long as it was wide. It expanded until it completely filled the screen. Thereafter, it was impossible to tell whether the image was being zoomed, as it showed no structure whatsoever.
"As I thought, there's nothing to see. Let's pan over to the edge of the thing."
Again, there was no sense of motion, until a field of stars suddenly appeared, sharply defined by the curving edge of the world-sized disk. It was exactly as if they were looking past the horizon of an airless, perfectly smooth planet. No, It was not perfectly smooth.
"That's interesting," commented the astronomer, who until now had sounded remarkably matter-of-fact, as if this sort of thing was an everyday occurrence. "The edge looks jagged, but in a very regular fashion, like a saw blade."
"A circular saw," Poole muttered under his breath. "Is it going to carve us up? Don't be ridiculous."
"This is as close as we can get before diffraction spoils the image. We'll process it later and get much better detail."
The magnification was now so great that all trace of the disk's circularity had vanished. Across the vidscreen was a black band, serrated along its edge with triangles so identical that Poole found it hard to avoid the ominous analogy of a saw blade, yet something else was nagging at the back of his mind. Like everyone else on Ganymede, he watched the infinitely more distant stars drifting in and out of those geometrically perfect valleys. Very probably, many others jumped to the same conclusion even before he did. If you attempt to make a disk out of rectangular blocks, whether their proportions are 1 to 4 to 9 or any other, it cannot possibly have a smooth edge. Of course, you can make it as near a perfect circle as you like by using smaller and smaller blocks, yet why go to that trouble if you merely wanted to build a screen large enough to eclipse a sun? The mayor was right. The eclipse was indeed temporary, but its ending was the precise opposite of a solar one. First, light broke through at the exact center, not in the usual necklace of Bailey's beads along the very edge. Jagged lines radiated from a dazzling pinhole, and now, under the highest magnification, the structure of the disk was being revealed. It was composed of millions of identical rectangles, perhaps the same size as the Great Wall of Europa, and now they were splitting apart. It was as if a gigantic jigsaw puzzle was being dismantled. Its perpetual but now briefly interrupted daylight was slowly returning to Ganymede, as the disk fragmented and the rays of Lucifer poured through the widening gaps. Now the components themselves were evaporating, almost as if they needed the reinforcement of each other's contact to maintain reality. Although it seemed like hours to the anxious watchers in Anubis City, the whole event lasted for less than 15 minutes. Not until it was all over did anyone pay attention to Europa itself. The Great Wall was gone. And it was almost an hour before the news came from Earth, Mars, and Moon that the sun itself had appeared to flicker for a few seconds before resuming business as usual. It had been a highly selective set of eclipses, obviously targeted at humankind. Nowhere else in the solar system would anything have been noticed. In the general excitement, it was a little longer before the world realized that TMA-0 and TMA-1 had both vanished, leaving only their 4-million-year-old imprints on Tycho and Africa. It was the first time the Europs could ever have met humans, but they seemed neither alarmed nor surprised by the huge creatures moving among them at such lightning speed. Of course, it was not easy to interpret the emotional state of something that looked like a small leafless bush with no obvious sense organs or means of communication. But if they were frightened by the arrival of Alcyone and the emergence of its passengers, they would surely have remained hiding in their igloos. As Frank Poole, slightly encumbered by his protective suit and the gift of shining copper wire he was carrying, walked into the untidy suburbs of Sienville, he wondered what the Europs thought of recent events. For them, there had been no eclipse of Lucifer, but the disappearance of the Great Wall must surely have been a shock. It had stood there for 1,000 years, as a shield and doubtless much more. Then, abruptly, it was gone, as if it had never been. The petabyte tablet was waiting for him, with a group of Europe standing around it, demonstrating the first sign of curiosity that Poole had ever observed in them. He wondered if Halman had somehow told them to watch over this gift from space until he came to collect it, and to take it back, since it now contained not only a sleeping friend, but terrors which some future age might exercise, to the only place where it could be safely stored. Chapter 40. Midnight. Pico. It would be hard, Poole thought, to imagine a more peaceful scene, especially after the trauma of the last weeks. The slanting rays of a nearly full earth revealed all the subtle details of the waterless sea of rains, not obliterating them as the incandescent fury of the sun would do. The small convoy of moon cars was arranged in a semicircle, 100 meters from the inconspicuous opening at the base of Pico that was the entrance to the vault. From this viewpoint, Poole could see that the mountain did not live up to the name that the early astronomers, misled by its pointed shadow, had given to it. It was more like a rounded hill than a sharp peak. And he could well believe that one of the local pastimes was bicycle riding to the summit. Until now, none of those sportsmen and women could have guessed at the secret hidden beneath their wheels. He hoped that the sinister knowledge would not discourage their healthy exercise. An hour ago, with a sense of mingled sadness and triumph, he had handed over the tablet he had brought, never letting it out of his sight, from Ganymede, directly to the moon. "Goodbye, old friends," he had murmured. "You've done well. Perhaps some future generation will reawaken you, but on the whole, I rather hope not." He could imagine all too clearly one desperate reason why Halman's knowledge might be needed again. By now, surely, some message was on its way to that unknown control center, bearing the news that its servant on Europa no longer existed. With reasonable luck, it would take 950 years, give or take a few, before any response could be expected. Poole had often cursed Einstein in the past. Now he blessed him. Even the powers behind the monoliths, it now appeared certain, could not spread their influence faster than the speed of light. So the human race should have almost a millennium to prepare for the next encounter, if indeed there was to be one. Perhaps by that time, it would be better prepared. Something was emerging from the tunnel. The track-mounted, semi-humanoid robot that had carried the tablet into the vault. It was almost comic to see a machine enclosed in the kind of isolation suit used as protection against deadly germs, and here on the airless moon. But no one was taking any chances, however unlikely they might seem. After all, the robot had moved among those carefully sequestered nightmares, and although, according to its video cameras, everything appeared in order, there was always a chance that some vial had leaked or some canister's seal had broken. The moon was a very stable environment, but during the centuries it had known many quakes and meteor impacts. The robot came to a halt 50 meters outside the tunnel. Slowly, the massive plug that sealed the vault swung back into place and began to rotate in its threads, like a giant bolt being screwed into the mountain. "All not wearing dark glasses, please close your eyes or look away from the robot," said an urgent voice over the moon car radio. Poole twisted round in his seat, just in time to see an explosion of light on the roof of the vehicle. When he turned back to look at Pico, all that was left of the robot was a heap of glowing slag. Even to someone who had spent much of his life surrounded by vacuum, it seemed altogether wrong that tendrils of smoke were not slowly spiraling up from it. "Sterilization completed," said the voice of the mission controller. "Thank you, everybody. Now returning to Plato City." How ironic that the human race had been saved by the skillful deployment of its own insanities. What moral, Poole wondered, could one possibly draw from that? He looked back at the beautiful blue earth, huddling beneath its tattered blanket of clouds for protection against the cold of space. Up there, a few weeks from now, he hoped to cradle his first grandson in his arms. "Whatever godlike powers and principalities lurked beyond the stars," Poole reminded himself. For ordinary humans, only two things were important: love and death. His body had not yet aged 100 years. He still had plenty of time for both. Epilogue. Their little universe is very young, and its god is still a child. But it is too soon to judge them. When we return in the last days, we will consider what should be saved. That is the end of 3001, The Final Odyssey. It was written by Arthur C. Clarke and read by Garrick Hagen.